If I bleed tonight, if I am sad tonight, I don't have a job to find. And if I work tonight, if I'm so tired tonight, I'll fall asleep when I'm home, when I'm home. Hey everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Power Slam podcast here on Inside the Ropes. My name is Kenny McIntosh, and I'm joined by my mentor, the Thelma to my Louise, the Austin to my Rock. It's Finn Martin. Hi Finn, how are you?
I'm doing all right, Kenny. Actually doing really good. Finished my Wrestle Talk magazine article, a big article that I did for the magazine on Tuesday, really late, about 11 o'clock at night when I finished it. So I've been catching up on my wrestling ever since, and here I am, Thursday afternoon at 4:56 to discuss AEW and NXT and some WWE as well.
There you go. You're getting about, Finn.
I'm getting about. I mean, it's good to keep the hand in doing the writing. I mean, between the Jim Ross interview that I did for Inside the Ropes last week, and the submissions for WrestleTalk magazine, feels like I'm almost back full-time writing again. And it's a nice feeling.
Good to get your voice back here. Are you prepared for the coronavirus outbreak that could break into your home at any time?
Well, that is one of the good things about doing this job, is that even if I did contract it, I could continue doing the podcast and continue doing my writing. So not that I'm suggesting for a moment that I want to get it. Of course I don't. And in fact, with my limited interaction with the rest of the human race, I think it's unlikely that I will catch it. But if I were, and the worst were to happen, the podcast would continue. How about yourself, Kenny? You interact with more people than I do.
You could be a conspiracy theorist. I mean, I don't know. Did you see that thing that was kicking about? There was a book from like 1981 called The Edge of Darkness or something, where it said in that book, in 2020, there will be a pneumonia-type virus that will sweep the world.
And it was
very specific. But, I was at the gym the other day, and my personal trainer had said that one of his clients' husbands works for the NHS, and he'd said, if this breaks out, 1% of the population will die of the coronavirus. Which, sounds horrific, but it's like, 4% of the population die of the flu. If you and I got it, the chances are we could, deal with it fairly easily. You'd be worried for people who have very low immune systems, the elderly, people who are more susceptible to that kind of stuff. But, it just feels a bit scaremongery in some of the coverage of it and all that kind of stuff. But I'll tell you this, if it fucking wrecks my Kevin Owens show or my WrestleMania trip, I'll be raging.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Yeah, I mean, it does feel like the media is catastrophizing about it. There isn't that many cases yet. As you say, literally hundreds of thousands of people die each year from the flu. So I don't know. It's the World Health Organization and the government agencies are kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't. If they spend too much time talking about it and really lay on too thick, then they're accused of causing people to panic and overreact. And if they don't do that, then they're accused of being asleep at the wheel and not doing more to prepare for, an imminent epidemic. So, hopefully, no one in this, obviously, I think there's about 90 people in the UK have been diagnosed now. I think it's something like that, 90, 91, yeah, something like that.
I think it's good that there's precautions, but hopefully it'll be fine.
Yeah,
that's what I'm telling myself. We've just announced another show with Trish Stratus in London this coming April, because later on this month she actually debuts in WWF. So the timing is pretty good. I was thinking about this yesterday when we were sort of like putting all the Trish stuff out there. She had to wade through a lot of shit, didn't she? Like, she had to do a lot of stuff back in the day that, like, you would never expect a woman nowadays to bark like a dog on air.
No,
and crawl on her hands and knees. Like, when you think about some of the stuff that she did, it was it's pretty harrowing.
It is. It absolutely is. I mean, we talked about this on the when we've done the retro podcast, you know, and how things are going to, you know, in the timeline. It was running up to WrestleMania 17 with a famous segment in February 2001 when Vince was there and he was like, humiliated Trish in the ring. That was the one that Sky famously I don't think did they show it or did they show or did they heavily edit it? I think they I can't remember whether it was heavily edited anyway when it was broadcast on Raw. So Sky had strong objections to the content of that angle, and understandably so. And I remember when the first time I saw it on the internet and I was quite shocked by it. But you know, you're right, and there was other things that she had to do as well. I mean, yeah, she had to go through a lot of stuff to become the star that she did. It's really hard to sort of talk about it now because the standards are completely different and no male or female performer would be asked to do anything like that in the, you know, in the TV PG era. It was TV 14 back then. It was still the Attitude era. So our standards and our expectations were very different, and we've been also desensitized as well to shock value TV. So the things that she was asked to do, with the exception of the infamous Bark Like a Dog segment, which of course came back to haunt the McMahons when Linda ran for the Senate. That was one of the things that Linda McMahon's opponents dug up, and that was used as you know, as evidence that she was unworthy to become a senator, and the public agreed, perhaps not for that reason, but for that reason and many others. But, you know, you go back to that era of 2000, 2001, and the things that talent did on a regular basis were far more objectionable than the things that people do now. So you did sort of become desensitized to it back then. You know, because the environment was just completely different, wasn't it, Kenny?
It was crazy. It was. I mean, there's so much stuff they did back in the day, and I think with Trish, it's like, I think it's. And I'm going to sound like I'm biased because she's coming over. I do feel like I've defended Trish before in some ways, and I do think that, like, you know, she. It's hard because when she came back and she had that match with Charlotte, and you kind of, you know, there's the conversations of, well, is Charlotte better than Trish? Is she up on her level? And it's like, well, Trish was never going to be able to be Charlotte's level because that wasn't what was around when she was around. And you were, you know, you were only, I think you talked about, you thought that Trish kind of got good in like 05.
05, yeah.
Kinda, and then, but then by 06, she'd kind of done everything. You know, so
she
like,
had.
Why would she have stuck around? There would have been no sense for Trish to stick around in 06, so she kind of left at the right time. But you do wonder if she had been able to be around in the time when it was like Sasha Banks and Charlotte and Becky and all that, you know, how it would have been. And I'm sure that played into the idea of her coming back and having that match with Charlotte last year because she wanted to sort of get in there with today's crop. And, you know, people like her and Beth Phoenix, you do kind of wish had come around a little bit later so that they could have been in that environment.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the overall standard of talent now is so much higher than it was back in 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005. So, I mean, and that would have automatically pushed her to be a better in-ring performer because she would have been working with superior workers. So, I mean, it's like if the overall standard is better, then, you know, unless you're completely inept, you will also improve. It just stands to reason. But, you know, you go back to the Attitude Era and women were very much presented as sex objects. You know, they were, you know, sexualized figures far more than they are now, where they're treated really as the equals of men and are seen as serious competitors. So the whole way that they're framed by the company has changed completely. And that's not just due to the TV, the rating of the content of the product changing from TV 14 to TV PG. But because attitudes and standards and expectations in society have changed, haven't they? So things that you could get away with back in 2000, 2001, you really couldn't get away with that now. You know, I think it's something that Impact Wrestling has really captured quite well with the Swinger character, where he's a character that's supposedly still thinks he's 1989 or 1991, and he misbehaves and talks about how it's acceptable to backstage to do things like spiking a performer's drink or dumping in someone's bag. And so he does that and he thinks it's hilarious. And all the other members of the roster are looking at him like he's a relic and like it's deeply offensive. And like, you can't do that. That's criminal or borderline criminal. And Swinger's there, like, just can't understand why these people don't see the funny side for things that his character finds amusing because he's living in another era. I think the Swinger character, even though probably very few people listening to this podcast are aware of it, the Swinger character really is captures it quite brilliantly. You know, the differences in how wrestling was back then to how it is now.
I mean, yeah, and I think, I mean, I've not watched the Swinger character stuff, but I've heard about it a little bit. So, yeah, I think it's, but yeah, the whole long convoluted conversation here is, come and see Trish if you're in the London area. Inside the ropes.co.uk/Trish. Anyway, lots to talk about this week. We are still on the fallout from the Goldberg Bray Wyatt Fiend situation. Now, I did want to ask you, because Goldberg was actually asked about the match, and I do have what he said somewhere. Where are we? Sorry, bear with me a second. So he was asked about
the... Oh, Kenny, get with the program.
Do you know what? Right, so I'll find it as we talk here, and I'll come back to it in a second. What we will talk about from... Similar to the Goldberg thing, because he was on SmackDown setting up his match with Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. But everybody wants to know, Finn, you're not going to get away with it because you were on the later podcast this week. John Cena made his triumphant return to SmackDown last Friday night. He came out with a tear in his eye. You know, it was the idea, is he going to retire? But instead, here comes the Fiend from behind. The Fiend points at the WrestleMania sign and the match is made. And I just wanted to get your take on this segment. Talk me through Cena's performance. Talk me through your excitement level for the big match. People are keen to know.
Through the roof is my excitement level. So, yeah, so Cena, the whole program's a homage to John Cena. And the rating went up as a result. So, I mean, you know, that's Vince's silent majority for you. All those people who were complaining about Goldberg, well, Goldberg's on the show. Show, whole SmackDown show on Friday is built around Goldberg, John Cena. Rating goes up. I mean, that was the highest number SmackDown's drawn, I think, since the first one on Fox. I think it did,
yeah,
did a bit of a number.
There.
Yeah, up there. So Cena comes out at the end. I mean, he's in Boston. It's his home state. You know, for years he was booed. He was cheered here. People liked him, Kenny. I mean, he comes out, thanks very much, tells everyone, cut a long story short, tells everyone that he believes in the future and that he's not going to wrestle at WrestleMania this year. He can't do. Even though, you know, at the click of his fingers, he could have any match of his choosing. Cena's not going to do that. You know, there's people in the locker who've waited years for their WrestleMania moment, and there's no way that Cena is going to deprive all those rank-and-file, full-time performers from having their WrestleMania moment because he's going to muscle his way in on the card. So there's all the boos, Cena's milking it. Now, the fake humility from Cena throughout this segment was quite, not extraordinary, just kind of typical, really, of John Cena. So he says he's not retiring, but this is goodbye for now. Doesn't know when he's going to appear in the wrestling ring again. People cheer. You know, they're upset that he's not going to be on the show. But, I mean, they're happy to see him. Cena leaves to cheers, gets to the top of the ramp. As you said, the Fiend comes out, points at the WrestleMania sign.
I'm shaking my head.
Cena's looking at it, turns to look at the Fiend. Nods, and that's it. I mean, bit of a U-turn there, Kenny. You know, from like, I'm not wrestling on the show. I'm not gonna steal the spot that someone who's been here all year, who's here week in, week out, you know, once on that show. I can't be on the WrestleMania show because that would be selfish of me to deprive someone else of that spot. And then Fiend comes out, points at the sign, Cena nods, and he's done a total about face. So Cena is now going to be on the show to wrestle a Fiend. So, yeah, you look at it. I mean, it was like, you look back on it and it's like, so Cena was dripping fake humility. I mean, his statements proved to be hollow. I mean, they weren't really convincing in the first place because we knew he wasn't coming back just to say goodbye. He was coming back to set something up for WrestleMania. So at no point was the speech convincing. So the whole thing in the end's proven to be false. So, I mean, in the final analysis, it's just like nonsensical and annoying. You know, which is, you know, kind of sums up almost every single one of John Cena's matches. So when you look at it, the whole angle was just, you could say it's an exercise in frustration, but then so is watching John Cena do whatever it is he does in the ring. So I guess it was kind of fitting, really, the angle to set up this match that I don't really have any desire to see because I didn't want to see it anyway, and certainly after The Fiend was trounced by Goldberg in Saudi Arabia, there's even less reason for me to want to watch this match.
The thing about it, so, I mean, I can sort of... I thought Cena did a decent enough job when he got to the point, which was, you know, it's about the Stars of Tomorrow, I'm going to go away from... I thought he did a decent enough job there.
I thought
it took us a little while to get there, and, you know, he was almost veering into, like, two... The humility was getting too fake, but then I thought he brought it back and he cut a decent enough promo. My issue here is not really anything to do with John Cena. I didn't think he was great. I didn't think he was terrible. I think he was fine. The problem for me was that, like, you come out of Saudi Arabia, and, you know, we'll talk about Goldberg in a second, but I think that what people miss here is that the complaints that people have are not that Goldberg beat Bray Wyatt. That's not really the complaint. The complaint is about the way it was executed. It's about execution. And this WrestleMania main event, you know, if you look at just the Fiend character, why would the Fiend character, right, who's just lost a title, you know, that yielded all this power or whatever, he just comes out and just points at a WrestleMania sign like he's any other guy in the roster?
Yeah.
It was so lazy. And, you know, I feel like we used to get these matches where it was like, I was going to give a 2000 example there, but I can't because Sandra will be listening to this. But, you know, if you look back at, like, 1998, the tag team match with Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie against the New Age Outlaws at WrestleMania 14, you know, part of the build to that was they got thrown off a fucking stage. And they were injured, and there was all this stuff that happened, and there was build-up, and, you know, Kane and The Undertaker, they had a sort of fake reunion, and then it didn't happen, and then we saw The Undertaker coming through the fires of hell, and a coffin was on fire. And all this stuff happened. And this match has so far been built by he points to a sign and Cena salutes to him.
Yeah.
And now maybe they do a great job between now and WrestleMania to build it. I'm just saying, I think you should, you know, have a hot start to an angle. And this was like when you run a bath, right? And you've put the good bubble bath in. You put the Radox, you put the salts and all that, you get your setup going, you pour yourself a wee glass of wine or a wee something, you get the candles on, and then you go to check the temperature of the water, and you didn't realise your boiler was broken and the fucking bath is cold.
Well, you should know all about that, Kenny.
I'm a fucking expert on that now. But that's what it's like. This was like lukewarm, cold water that just, you know, on the surface could be really, you know, exciting, and just, no, nothing.
It was just so uninspiring and unimaginative and just so phony. Every part of it, I mean, we knew that when Cena was out there, that nothing he was saying was true because he was there to announce a match. And the whole thing was just like, oh, we're going to take the fans down so we can build them back up. So I'm going to dash their hopes, but it doesn't matter because at the end I'm going to give them what they want. And it's just like, well, we went from point A to point C without point B, really. Because you had Cena say, no, I can't wrestle on the show because that would be selfish of me to do that and to take the place of one or more other more full-time performers who are the future of this company who need to wrestle at WrestleMania. And then, in a way, it was actually had what he'd done there, had had he actually told the truth and adhered to what he was saying and not immediately reneged upon it, I would have really respected him for it, because what Cena was saying in the ring was absolutely true, was absolutely right. I'm sure there's loads of people in the locker room who obviously knew how this was going to end and wouldn't have fallen for it for a moment, were probably thinking to themselves, if only what Cena is saying were what is going to happen, or were what is the plan for WrestleMania. And instead it was a straight U-turn, it was a con job, it was just a scam, it was just a way of filling time. And they could have filled time and set it up in another way where it would have made sense. It just made no sense. We got from A to C without B. I mean, what would have made more sense if you couldn't really... If you wanted to use exactly the same verbiage that Cena spoke in the ring on SmackDown on Friday, he could have done that, then he could have gone up on the ramp. Wyatt could have attacked him from behind, left him laying. Wyatt could have then, like, you know, lights could have then gone off, the scary laughter could have been audible. Then Fiend could have retreated. Sorry, not Wyatt. The Fiend could have retreated. Cena could have been left laying on the stage. Shaw could have gone off the air. And then we could have had Cena out on next week's SmackDown, or if he didn't want to appear on SmackDown, he could have sent in a video or whatever, and just said, I know what I said last week, but the Fiend came out and I cannot let that lie. You know, I cannot, I have to face him in the ring. And then, you know, at least that would have been then justification for him doing the U-turn and going back on his word and saying, you know, I apologize to everyone in the locker room, but I cannot let this lie. You know, I have to have my retribution. I have to settle a score with the Fiend. And that would have made more sense than this, wouldn't it, Kenny?
Yeah. I think people were watching hoping for a WrestleMania angle, and I just don't think they got one. Speaking of which, earlier on that show, we had Goldberg come out saying, you know, and he was getting boos, as we kind of predicted he would. He seemed to see that they were coming, which meant that he was a little bit more comfortable than I guess he would have been if he didn't expect it. And then Roman Reigns basically came out and said, I'm next, and that's the match. That was the WrestleMania match. I do want to just read this out to you. This is what Goldberg had to say. He was on The Bump, WWE's show The Bump. And here's two things that he said, and I just wanted to get your take and response to his comments. So he was asked to give a response to the people who criticised his victory. Here's what he said. I'd love to see them do it at any age, let alone at 53. I answered a phone call and I did whatever I had to do to get ready in a short period of time and provide a little bit of Goldberg out there. Fortunately, I was able to do it and I'm looking forward to the next one. If I get a phone call and I believe that I can still do what I did back in the day to at least an acceptable level, then I'm not going to say no. If you give me a challenge, I'm going to take it. And then he followed that up with talking about how the average wrestling fan has changed in the last 20 years. He said, it's truly a different community out there. The wrestling business has changed exponentially with the internet and mostly with the fans who pay their hard-earned money and go out there and talk negatively about us. I suppose they can do whatever they want. I think at the end of the day, people are more concerned with being that... I think people are more concerned with being that guy who started that negative chant. It's not enough to be part of the show anymore. They want it to be their show, and that isn't the case. And he then finished off by talking about the Roman Reigns match at WrestleMania. He said, I came here for a reason, and that's the reason why I came. He's been in my sight since I heard that he played for Georgia Tech, and he does the spear. I love Roman to death. I greatly appreciate what he has done as an entertainer. And outside of the ring, I'm one of his number one fans. There's no animosity there. I just have a job to do. Babyface, heel. I don't give a damn what it is. I'm going to go out there and rip his face off like I do with everyone else. So that was kind of what his response was to the feedback. What do you make of it?
Well, in terms of he's talking about fans today being different, what about his WrestleMania 20 experience, which was 16 years ago? And wasn't one of the people in the crowd leading those chants Shane McMahon?
You wrote about that at the time? Yep. So fill people in on that. People don't know that. Shane McMahon, so because Goldberg and Lesnar were both leaving...
Yes.
And people were chatting, you know, na na na, hey, goodbye. And Shane McMahon was in the crowd singing along.
Singing along. He was there famously. And he was like spotted doing it. Like, well, I'm not saying he started the chants, but he was leading them. People would have been aware that he was there. He was a public figure. And when fans saw him do it, they would have been probably more likely to mimic his behaviour. I mean, it's like, obviously the mob mentality took over there. Everyone knew what was going on. But, I mean, the reaction there was so vociferous, you know, so hostile. I mean, the level of hostility to that match, I don't know whether I've seen anything or heard anything or witnessed anything quite that bad since. I mean, Cena's had some, you know, some rough rides out there. And obviously Roman Reigns, he's had a rough time as well of it. At, you know, WrestleMania, obviously Royal Rumble 2015, fans were booing him out of the building there. So, I mean, Reigns has had a tough time as well. But, I mean, you know, Goldberg Lesnar at WrestleMania 20 is, like, notorious. It's the stuff of legend. So, I mean, have fans really changed that much? I don't think they have. You know, I've been watching this a long time now. As of you, Kenny, and as of lots of people listening to this podcast, I mean, I remember when Hogan came back at WrestleMania 9. Yokozuna defeated Bret Hart for the WWF Heavyweight title in the main event show, as people know. Then Hogan comes out, you know, and Bret Hart's there. Is he saying to Hogan, go in the ring and take him on? You know, it's a bit of, you know, ambiguity there. Hogan gets in the ring, beats Yokozuna in whatever it was, 30 seconds or something ridiculous for the title. Actually, if you go back and watch the match, which I did recently for my WrestleTalk article, it did receive a fairly favourable reaction at Caesar's Palace. But in the, you know, wider wrestling, diehard wrestling fan community, they were up in arms. They were furious about it. So, I mean, this is long before Goldberg, you know, ever even thought about becoming a pro wrestler, and fans were reacting like that. So, you know, Goldberg may believe what he said, but it's just simply not true. These type of fans have always been there. You know, fans were furious. Lots of, you know, hardcore, diehard fans, whatever you want to call them, WWF loyalists, they were furious that Hogan had come back. You know, we've been told for months that Bret Hart was the new face of the company ever since he defeated Ric Flair for the belt back in October 1992. And then here we were, April 1993, and Hogan, the guy, you know, who'd be the face of the company in the 1980s, who moved on, actually fled the company because of the steroid scandal, but it was a veteran anyway and seen very much as, you know, a real, you know, passé figure, somebody who was, you know, really seen as a relic at the time, which is kind of amazing, really, when you think he was not that old, was he, in April 1983? He would have been 39, I think he would have been at that point. August 53, wasn't it, Hogan was born?
Yes.
So he would have turned 40 that year. So he was still only 39. But Hogan was really seen as, you know, a figure from the past, and that Bret was supposed to be the to the future. And these mixed message, these contrary messages that WWF was transmitting, that, oh no, this guy that we told you like 2 weeks ago was the face of the company, well, he isn't really as big a star as this Hulk Hogan guy. So he's the person you're supposed to cheer now. And that's what really annoyed people at the time. So, I mean, fans have reacted, you know, fans have rejected booking decisions for decades. So for Goldberg to say that's simply not true.
Well, we talked about this on our Super Showdown review on Patreon. I do feel in some ways for Goldberg that I know he only had like 3 weeks to prepare, or okay, 4 weeks, whatever. So I get that, you know, it's not like he had 2 months and was able to do it. But yeah, at the same time, if there had been a good story and the performance had been better, I don't think people would have had as much of a problem. So I think that, you know, you kind of have to take some responsibility for when something just doesn't go well, you know.
Just to answer the first part of, you know, the Goldberg thing. So he was saying, well, I took a phone call and so I decided to do it. Well, you didn't have to do it. So you've taken a phone call to come back, get paid 7 figures to beat this guy that WWE had spent the last 10 months building up as this new invincible, unstoppable force. So, you know, the fact that he took that phone call and agreed to do it, I mean, maybe he wasn't aware of who the Fiend was or what the character was or what it had done or what it had been or the connection it had with the audience. Well, more fool him for not doing his due diligence. You know, I mean, it's not like, You know, it's not like he was obligated to do this or this was some compulsory act. He was paid a fantastic amount of money to come back and squash this guy that the company, as was the case with Bret Hart when he defeated Ric Flair in October 1992, The Fiend, 2019-2020, we've been told that he's this invincible force that no one can beat. And now this, you know, old guy comes back and then just squashes him in less than 3 minutes. What reaction did he expect from the audience to that? I mean, he was basically the instrument of destruction, wasn't he, from Vince McMahon? Didn't Vince use that phrase when he got WO back in 2002? I thought I'd heard it somewhere before. Everything's recycled.
The thing is, I think the thing is now, like, I mean, Goldberg is kind of, and he obviously looks much better, but he's kind of like if, you know, Pedro Morales came back to beat The Rock or something in 1998, and it's like, well, Pedro Morales probably wouldn't really have a clue what's going on in 1998 in wrestling, because he probably didn't keep up with it. I don't think Goldberg really keeps up with it that often. I mean, he knows who people are, but...
don't accept the money then. You know, I mean, there's no excuse.
Or accept
absolutely
the money.
Absolutely no excuse.
Accept the money, but then don't try to make out, like, you know, don't try and use that you had to do it as an excuse.
We didn't stop weaseling your way out of it. Just, you know, what's that phrase that people say now? Own it. You know, it's just like you took the money to come in and bury this guy. You didn't have to do it. You've been paid handsomely for it. And people are upset because you've come back and squashed this guy. And okay, it was Vince McMahon's decision for this to happen. But had Goldberg not agreed to do it, it wouldn't have happened. And he's been paid a fantastic amount of money for doing it. So I've got no sympathy for Goldberg at all. Having witnessed the reaction to the angle with Roman Reigns on SmackDown, I feel sure that Goldberg is going to be punished at WrestleMania. And you know what? I'll have no sympathy for him at all on the night, because he damn well deserves it.
So let's move over to AEW. So AEW had the Dynamite show last night on March 4th. It was live in the outskirts of Denver, Colorado, in Broomfield. It was the fallout from Revolution. Obviously, as we go through here, we'll talk about some of the Revolution stuff as well. But as a sort of fallout show from the pay-per-view, how do you think they did, generally?
I thought what they did with it was they kept everything moving forward. And I don't like those shows. And WWE did this last year right after WrestleMania, where they spent too much time talking about what had just happened rather than preparing for what was going to happen. So I felt like on this week's Dynamite, obviously there was acknowledgement of what had occurred at Revolution, but it felt to me like a very progressive show where they were setting things up for the future. So, I mean, I think overall, you know, I thought it was a really solid piece of business. Never sagged at all. Even the match that, you know, probably the worst match was on the show was Big Swole versus Lever Bates. That was a squash. That was over quickly. I thought it had really good energy. The pacing was good. And it really sort of moved things along to the next event. So, I mean, you know, overall, I really enjoyed it. What did you think, Kenny?
I thought it was a good show. I think it's the first time where, I mean, we should just mention it because we would bring it up for MDL. You know, they did advertise that Lance Archer was going to be on this show and he wasn't on the show. I think that's the first time they've, like, not carried through with an advertisement. But, you know, apparently, you know, the creative plan for him changed, and that was why he wasn't on the show. But it should be noted that that was there. Obviously, before this show, you saw the clip of the Free the Delete show with Matt Hardy, I'm guessing, with Matt Hardy at his compound and the Young Bucks coming out of the SUV with him saying, you know, the Bucks of Youth, I knew you'd come. And then the video ends. So I think there was a... Maybe people were kind of expecting that he was going to be on the show, or there was going to be something with the Dark Order that was going to progress a little bit. So I think that that's maybe the only underwhelming element of the show, is that people were kind of probably hoping for a little bit more in regards to that storyline.
Yeah, I mean, I'm aware of the fact that they, because there was a big graphic, wasn't there, on the previous week's show.
The Exalted One is on his way.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, the thing is, I mean, to me, that's nitpicking. I mean, okay, yeah, that should have happened. But I mean, I think overall, there was enough good things on this show to really offset any of the complaints that I would have.
One of the other things that was pointed out to me today, and I didn't really think about this before the show, because obviously on this show, we're not going to go through every single thing that happens, but after the match with Pac and Chuck Taylor, we ended up getting the formation of the Death Triangle with Pac and the Lucha Brothers. And somebody had kind of put it out, and I didn't really realize it, you know, they now have enough trios teams to do a tournament and to have trios titles if they choose to go down that way eventually. Because, so for example, here's the eight trios teams that they now have. They have the Elite, which is the Bucks and Kenny, the Nightmare Family, which is Cody, QT Marshall and Dustin, the Dark Order, Death Triangle, Best Friends, SCU, the Inner Circle with, you know, Proud and Powerful and Sammy, Jurassic Express and Strong Hearts. So I feel like they're silently kind of creating all these trios teams that are there, while there's also a tag division, while also some of the people in these teams wrestle singularly. So I think they should really be called for the kind of clever booking that's kind of bubbling underneath, but not terribly obviously. But if they did decide to go down that route, they have enough teams to sort of do a tournament if need be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was something that Crockett Promotions had, was a six-man title. So, I mean, that was something, I'm pretty sure Dusty held that belt. So held was what was a co-holder of that championship. So it would not surprise me if that was something that they did. And that's something that WWE doesn't have, a six-man championship. So that would be something that would be individual to AEW. I know other promotions have a six-man tag team title, but I think that would be something that AEW could do, and it would be, you know, something that would be an asset to their company that would distinguish them from WWE and NXT. And it does feel to me like they are heading in that direction for sure. Yeah,
which would be clever, because it's something different, and it doesn't feel like it's, you know, it's like when WWE brought in the women's tag titles last year, I think it was. I mean, there wasn't really enough teams to do it, but I like the idea that there's kind of, because I didn't realize it, so I think it was David Bixenspan had tweeted out all the trios teams, that they're all kind of bubbling underneath, ready to go if they decide to pull that trigger, so good for them. Let me just ask you very quickly, before we go into kind of some of the happenings on Dynamite, Revolution overall, as a pay-per-view offering, how do you think they did?
I thought it was a good show. There were some parts of it I liked and other parts I didn't like. But, I mean, I thought overall most of what happened on there made sense. I thought there was some real standout performers there. Definitely want to give, you know, huge credit to Orange Cassidy for his performance against Pac. I thought that was just tremendous. The babyface fire he had and his crowd interaction. And this coming as well, just before the main event and after the Cody and MJF match, which I thought lasted far too long. You know, this was threatening to be like a buffer match. You know, often on WWE shows, we're going to see this at WrestleMania probably several times. They'll have matches that are just the kind of buffer matches that are there to allow the audience to recuperate. And it almost seemed like this might have been one of those matches, and it was quite the reverse. So, I mean, I was just blown away by the performance of Orange Cassidy and Pac as well. He was a great setup man. You know, huge, huge. I mean, Pac's a real pro, so smooth, so precise, you know, such a professional, so competent, so capable in the ring. And of course, Pac had to win, and he did. But, I mean, what a performance by Cassidy here. It'll be interesting to see whether this guy's got legs as a performer, or whether it's just going to be, you know, like it's going to be a short-lived thing and he's going to burn out quickly. But I really enjoyed that. I thought, what's his name, Darby Allin, had a terrific night as well against Sammy Guevara.
They were both long-term stories that they've built, by Orange Cassidy never trying, in inverted commas, and then Darby Allin never having the big win. So, you know, the fact that they were able to kind of have those bubble throughout the months of TV and even the specials beforehand, kind of, you know, because they pulled that Orange Cassidy trigger at the right time.
Yeah.
And like you say, it was so much fun. There's so many people who have, because I was kind of on the fence about him. I saw him live and he is very fun. But, you know, I thought they did a great job with it as well. But, and I, there's a lot of people who I think were on the fence about him who are kind of now fans of him. So he did a great job.
Well, in fact, Kenny, you were just telling me before we went on the air that you never considered this before, but you're now thinking of investing in Double Denim.
I can say that Double Denim is a look. I don't think I could pull it off half as well as Orange Cassidy. I think he is. I think if I was to wear Double Denim, I'd look like I'm trying it for Wham.
I've got a Double Denim outfit. I haven't worn it for a while. I think I look all right in it, but I'm, you know, there's a bit of a stigma about Double Denim. So I'm not sure. You know, now I'm in my 50s. I'm not sure if I can go back down the double denim route again in my life.
I feel like we could just, let's get you a comb, let's comb over the hair, let's get the Ray-Bans on. Maybe you could get in on the Best Friends act.
Well, exactly what, I could put my double denim on, and instead of the Orange Cassidy t-shirt, I could put one of those Power Slam t-shirts on. That looked pretty cool, wouldn't it?
If you do that, I want pictorial evidence immediately. Immediately.
So I thought Darby Allin versus Sammy Guevara, I thought it was a tremendous match, so well put together. I mean, there's some crazy bumps in there, but nothing like, you know, like when the AEW first started, we I think the pair of us were united in our, is condemnation the word, of Darby Allin's coffin drop on the ring apron. We're like, we don't want to see that again. And it seemed to me here like he was playing it safe. I mean, they were doing a lot of crazy things, but it didn't seem like they were taking too many unnecessary risks. So I thought that match was so well put together, absolutely the right outcome. Sammy Guevara, I think, was even enhanced, even in defeat. So it's kind of like your perfect booking. So really enjoy that. Other person I just want to point out, I thought I had a tremendous night, and she's not even a performer, Jake Hager's missus. She was fantastic.
She was good. I mean, not to be a Debbie Downer, I do think the kind of Dustin giving her a forced kiss when she hadn't done anything was a bit unwarranted. But she definitely had scope to be, you know, she could be in Hager's corner at some point. She did seem like she had the kind of wits to be in pro wrestling.
Yeah, I'm not condoning that either. So, but what I'm saying is, I just thought she showed a lot of personality. You know, I thought she was really into it. She was engaging. I think she thought she just had, you know, everything that Brandi Rhodes doesn't have. So I thought she was really good as a performer there. And I enjoyed the Hager versus Dustin Rhodes match. Kind of felt like it lasted too long.
It should have been about 7 minutes. It should not have been 14. It just was. Yeah. It got kind of generic.
It did. We were out there too long. I understand that they want to protect Dustin because he's the veteran, you know, he's Cody's brother and everything. But Jake Hager in his first match, I think he should have looked more commanding in his victory. And I mean, it's too soon to, I mean, I'm not a fan of his submission hold finish, but I mean, it's, you know, it's too soon to really knock it because we've only seen it twice so far. Once at Revolution, obviously he's only wrestled two matches. Twice at, we saw it at Revolution and we saw it on Dynamite this week. So, yeah, I'm not a massive fan of his finisher, but maybe that will grow on me. So, I mean, those were the matches that I really enjoyed the most. I mean,
we'll go through some of Dynamite, and obviously other stuff from Revolution will come out of it. So, for example, we had John Moxley open the show, the new AEW World Champion. He talked about, you know, there was a You Deserve It chant, and he was saying that this belt represents bringing back pro wrestling, and the belt belongs to the fans, and all this kind of stuff. And Jericho comes out with the Inner Circle. They basically say that, I think it's the whole thing about the Moxley era, and people, you know, Jericho's asking the fans if they like the Moxley era, and Jericho says, "I don't, I think it sucks ass." And then the fans chant, "You suck ass," at Chris Jericho. And basically, Jericho says that what he's going to do is he's going to, by the end of the night, he is going to leave John Moxley laying, and so he won't be able to walk out of the building on his own 2 feet. And if he doesn't do that, he will take a 30-day leave of absence. He upped it to 60 days, and that led us into the main event tag match, which was Darby Allin and Moxley against the Inner Circle, Guevara and Jericho. But the Inner Circle took Moxley out before the match, so it ended up being 2-on-1. Darby Allin valiantly trying to take out Jericho and Guevara. There was a really great spot of Darby trying to do a dive outside, and Jericho catching part of the Judas effect on him.
Yeah.
And that led to the pinfall, but Darby really looked great as a sort of valiant babyface. And then post-match, the Inner Circle ended up taking out a returning John Moxley and powerbombing him off the stage. So lots of stuff happening there. Talk me through your thoughts on Moxley getting the belt and how good or how effective was the sort of fallout that they played out in Dynamite with that opening promo in the main event match?
Yeah, I mean, it was... Chris Jericho at times kind of comes across as a bit of a pantomime villain, but I mean, it works for him.
Oh, no, he doesn't.
So, I mean, it works for him. You can't really knock Jericho at this point because of the level that he's at and he's successful. So, I mean, there's a lot of humour there. I mean, I've got to say, I was tickled by the comment he made that... that the outcome of their match at Revolution was unfair because Jericho said that he'd spent the better part of 3 months training to face a one-eyed man. So that means that it was an unfair result. It's just absurd. It's pro wrestling large and live, so I mean, it's supposed to be silly. But at times, you know, for a guy who's the top heel in the company, I just think he should be more serious at times. But he gets away with it. It's Jericho. So as you said, he stated that he would have taken a leave of absence if Moxley could walk out of the building that night or walk out of the arena that night under his own steam. And it was a bit of a strange suggestion. So and
we should anyway. We should mention why that I guess why he did that and why I guess it kind of maybe works is that the previous couple of days Fozzy's whole touring schedule had come out.
Yeah.
And there's a load of gigs over the next 2 months. I think it was Jericho's idea to kind of like do it with the idea that people would think that he's going to have to take the time off. But in reality, he's not.
Yeah, well, I mean, with AEW only doing one show a week, I'm sure he's arranged the schedule so he can still appear on AEW each Wednesday.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a lot easier right now with only having one show per week to do. So, I mean... Yeah, I'm sure it's not going to impede upon his AEW appearances. But yeah, I'm sure that was also the reason why he did it, because people thought, oh, yeah, he's going to lose for sure. But I mean, really, after Jericho had lost the title to Moxley at Revolution, he and the Inner Circle needed a show of force here, and that's what they gave us. So it was Jericho and Sammy Guevara versus Darby Allin and John Moxley in the main event, or at least it was supposed to be, as Moxley was making his entrance. Three masked men attack John Moxley. I mean, at this point, the announcers did annoy me because they started playing dumb. Oh, who are these people? We've got to get security over here. They're wearing AEW jackets. It was obviously Santana and Ortiz and Jake Hager. So and then they took the masks off. Oh, look who he is. I can't believe it. So they beat Moxley down in the backstage area. Well, not the backstage area, just in the like the concourse, I think it was, wasn't it? So they beat him down there. And then I thought for sure that Moxley would come out for the finish of the match, but he didn't do so. I thought that was quite an interesting touch as well, because that's generally what happens in these situations, that the... especially the babyface champion as well, he would make his, you know, he would run in just before the finish and save his partner. That didn't happen. So that was unexpected. So Moxie's supposedly beaten down, you know, he's there with the doctor, he won't let him go to the ring. So Darby Allin has to wrestle Jericho and Sammy Guevara on his own. And this was really well done. Again, a super spirited performance from Darby Allin. Hager and Ortiz and Santana were at ringside. So effectively, it was one against five. But even though Allen's like really quite small, it was believable. I mean, you know, at one point he did the coffin drop outside the ring, didn't he, onto basically the whole Inner Circle, didn't he, Kenny?
He did, yeah.
Which looked tremendous. And the audience are so into it. You know, it's got a huge atmosphere. You know, can Darby Allin pull off the upset? And of course, he didn't do. But, I mean, the Inner Circle had to use skullduggery in order to defeat this plucky babyface, as you say. Jericho nailed him from the outside, and then Guevara scored the pin. So, I mean, this was another stature enhancer. This enriched Darby Allin. So it was a great week for him, tremendous. Then the show ends, John Moxley comes out. He's selling for America. He's got like a steel chair. He's staggering out. He's in pain. Really goes for the inner circle. Looks like he really wants to beat him down. And I thought the intensity that Moxley displayed when he entered the ring to get at the inner circle, it was like, you know, the antithesis of what we saw from him and Seth Rollins in their famous match at the December pay-per-view. Was it, remember when they had that match? Was it TLC? Which year would that have been? 2018, would it have been?
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was 2018.
That's right, yeah. You know, and they had that big grudge match, and then neither of them wrestled it like it was a grudge match. So, I mean, this was like night and day. This was how it should have been here. And, of course, he was overwhelmed, as he should have been, because he's injured and it's 1-5, and they beat him down. I thought that was all very believable, you know, with a pro wrestling framework of how that all happened. I didn't think there was any sort of cartoon sort of performances here or, you know, silly choreographed stuff, which we see from some AEW performers. And they beat him up, took him up on the stage and hit him with the Shield powerbomb through a table. So Moxley couldn't leave under his own steam. So, I mean, some people, I think, objected to them doing the Shield powerbomb, and they kind of felt like it was, you know, an unnecessary, needless dig at WWE. But, I mean, it didn't really bother me. I mean, I wasn't bothered about that. And seeing, you know, Moxley take the powerbomb through the table, that all, it was all a lot of padding there, all looked very safe. So, yeah, I thought it was a really strong end to the show. It was exactly what needed to happen, where the inner circle asserted their authority again after Jericho had lost the title at the pay-per-view.
Well, it also importantly featured Darby Allin again and made him feel like he's a growing star in the company. The other big story on Dynamite, or one of the big stories on Dynamite we should mention, is that Cody came out to do a promo to talk about his loss to MJF. He wants MJF to come out and look him in the eye and tell him that he beat him fair and square, when out comes, was not expecting it, Jake the Snake Roberts comes out. He basically says that he's tired of Cody crying and bitching, that he got whipped like a dog by that punk. And then he says that he has a client. The Dark Side will be coming to AEW. It'll be like a phoenix rising from the ashes. It's taken him 20 years to get this right. And he's got someone. They're coming, and they're coming for Cody. What did you make of the promo? Has Jake still got it on the mic? Does he still do it for you? And what do you make of the idea of having Jake as a manager?
Well, I mean, it was a cryptic promo, wasn't it? I mean, you know, at least you hope it was. You hope it was cryptic and not that Jake was failing to make any sense, and that, you know, he hit all his points there and that everything he said was what he wanted to say and that he didn't get lost in the process of cutting that promo on Cody. I thought it was something unexpected. I suggested quite a few times back in when I was in the magazine, and I don't know if I've ever mentioned it on this podcast, but I always thought that Jake could have been somebody who could have been a big part of the Wyatt family when that was around. And I always felt like he could have been like the spiritual leader of the Wyatt family, and he could have played a very important and I think beneficial role in the development of the Wyatt family. Because my own memory of the Wyatt family was it started off so well and had so much promise, and then it kind of hit a wall and never went any further. And I always felt like they really squandered its potential by not allowing it to grow and do the things that I felt it could do. So, I mean, it seems to me like they've got Jake Roberts in here. You never really know what's going to happen with Jake. I mean, his voice is pretty shot from all the drug abuse, sadly. But, I mean, you could still understand him. And I remember he made an appearance in WWE, I don't know how many years ago this was now, and he was almost unintelligible. It sounded like his voice was so far gone that you could hardly understand what he was saying. Here was definitely better. So, I don't know. I mean, we'll see where he goes. But, I mean, Cody sold it. Cody's body language, I think, was very important here, because he gave Jake the respect and didn't try and attack him or laugh him off. Or, I mean, this was like the reverse of Goldberg and the Fiend. You know what I mean? Cody was like, oh my God, you know, what's he suggesting? What's he hinting at? Who's he referring to? Who's this client? What could this mean? You know, what Because at some point in this process here, Roberts took a shot at Arn Anderson, didn't he? Did he call him, was it a one-trick pony, I think he referred to
him
as?
He did, yeah. He called him a one-trick pony.
So I thought that was quite funny as well. So he's setting something up there between him and Arn Anderson, which also has a lot of possibilities. So we'll see what Arn's got left as a promo guy. So that could be quite interesting. Arn versus Jake on the stick. So that's another element to it that's interesting. And where could that go?
And he did finish the promo by saying, "A wise man once said to never turn your back on somebody you respect or that you're afraid of."
And then he turned his back on Cody, didn't he?
So it was like there was nice subtleties to it. I think, you know, the elephant in the room is obviously Jake has a lot of demons from his past, but I do think that, you know, there's not been any stories of him having any sort of bad experiences in the last few years.
No.
And you know what, like, I think it's worth giving him a shot. And, you know, I don't think this company will stand for anything if things do go sour, but I think it's definitely worth a punt.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's been straight now for at least, it was 6 years ago, wasn't it, when he was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame? 2014, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, it was just before I closed Power Slam. So, I mean, and he'd been straight for, I know, quite a few months prior to that. So, I mean, we're talking 6 years now, and I haven't really heard any stories either. So, and as you say, if anything happens and Jake gets out of line, I think they'll have a zero tolerance policy with him. And that's what they need to have. But, I mean, you know, especially with a guy like Jake's obviously got a long history, decades of substance abuse. But, I mean, I think he's going to be all right. We'll see anyway. But, I mean, there's a lot to take from this promo. I don't know whether it was such an amazing promo, but it was an interesting promo and it sets lots of things up. And that was really, to me, kind of the theme of the show, was really moving things along from Revolution. And that's, you know, that's why I really enjoyed the program. Do we know who Jake's referring to, Kenny?
I mean, I'm assuming it's either going to be Lance Archer, which would make sense of why he wasn't on the show, or maybe it's Brody Lee, Luke Harper. I assume it's going to be one of those two.
Okay. Yeah, I would think so as well. That was my reaction to this. And if that is the case, then to me it's perfectly justified in Lance Archer not being there, because Jake, to me, was more than a worthy substitute. And we can wait another week. We can wait 2 weeks if we have to. And maybe Jake will make another appearance on Dynamite next week to say something else and to further this storyline. And I would be all for that, you know, especially after seeing, you know, the complete failure by WWE to give us anything to sink our teeth into when it comes to Cena and The Fiend and Roman Reigns and Goldberg. You know, I'm all for more story development, and let's spin this thing out. You know, let's do the reverse of what WWE's doing.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing on this show was there was a lots of little things happening. Like, we had Britt Baker on commentary kind of furthering that Tony Schiavone thing with the Starbucks cup. We had Sean Spears with Tully Blanchard talking about how he's still looking for a partner. So they had all these wee things going on. But to me, the other big element of the show was after the QT Marshall and Jake Hager match, where Hager gets the win, and then obviously, you know, Dustin runs out, we've got the Inner Circle, and Cody runs out, that Matt Jackson runs out, and then Hangman Page comes out for the save, and he ends up coming out and doing the Buckshot Lariat, I think, to Hager. I think it was Hager he did it to. And then, you know, he just took his beer, which he'd placed in the corner, went over to Matt Jackson, who was, again, just being sanctimonious and, you know, elitist to him. And just flipped
elitist,
him off.
Elitist, I like it.
Sorry?
Elitist, I like it.
I've got to give it to Sandra. She claimed they're the elitists at the moment, and they do seem to be. But they're playing it really well. And when he flipped them off, you were just like, yeah, flip those motherfuckers off. Yeah. Hangman Page, what a turnaround. I really am digging his character. And he's just so relatable as someone who, like, everybody's had those people in their life who are, you know, very good at something, or they lord things over you a little bit. They're just those kind of people, and that's what the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega have kind of become a little bit. And Hangman Page is just telling them to go fuck themselves, and it's just I think it's really working, and the fans are really connecting to Page.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, you know, since we've been talking about fashion on this podcast, what do you make to Hangman Page's country and western shirts and those and that big belt buckle, Kenny?
I mean, it's only something I could dream of, Finn. Because if I did that in Glasgow, I would look like an absolute fanny. Whereas he can do it, and because he's American and he has a horse and he's a cowboy, he can get away with it. So more power to him. I'm just jealous that I can't pull it off. What do you think? Who would you rather be dressed as? Orange Cassidy or Hangman Page?
Oh, Orange Cassidy. And in fact, you really? Know, when this podcast ends, I'm going to put my double denim on.
Why not? It's a Thursday. Enjoy yourself.
See if I can still pull it off at 50.
I'm sure you can. But
I mean, I didn't really... I thought the match between Jake Hager and QT Marshall, I thought, again, that lasted too long and Hager should have won this fairly easily, really. That would be my only complaint, but still he won the match. And we had all these run-ins, you know, we had Dustin jumping into the ring and then Santana and Ortiz, Cody, Matt Jackson, and as you say, Hangman Page. And that was quite interesting that he was like the star of the show here, wasn't he? And you were just saying, wow, we could never have predicted this. And you're right, Hangman Page was the star of this segment. And you're like, I could never have predicted that 3 or 4 months ago. Absolutely no way, or even 2 months ago, that he would be the star of a segment featuring all those other people. And yeah, it was quite interesting because when he came out, he was kind of feigning inebriation. And then he proved that he was all right and hit the buckshot lariat on Hager. And that looked tremendous. And fans were really into him. And then left with his beer, but he's still, you know, there's still tension between him and Matt Jackson, and understandably so. I mean, who wouldn't have tension with Matt Jackson with the way he's been behaving, Kenny? You know what I mean? You reap what you sow, you know what I mean? Just like Goldberg.
It's building well, and I think it is going to build to the Young Bucks being heels and Paige being the big babyface, which I think is a better sort of alignment of roles.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, and I like the way that they're not rushing this, they're taking the time. I mean, I don't know whether they've got a date in mind when they're going to do the big turn with the Young Bucks and Omega doing the split from Paige. And that was, you said, we were talking earlier about trios. You know, Omega and the Young Bucks, they could become a heel trio, couldn't they? And vie for these six-man belts if AEW choose to create a six-man title. So, I mean, that would be a really good squad as well. And Paige could team up with some two other guys if he wanted to and potentially face Omega and the Young Bucks, which you would think that would be the logical next thing after this turn occurs. So, yeah, I think they're doing a really good job setting it up. And, you know, my advice to AEW is take your time because people are really enjoying this. They're savouring this. They're enjoying the journey. You know, don't take us to the destination. We don't want to reach that destination before we're ready, and we're not ready yet.
Exactly. And so, I mean, that's kind of Dynamite. That's where things are.
Just mention one just thing about MJF.
Oh, yeah, his promo with his I pinned Cody t-shirt on.
That's right, yeah. So that was quite funny. And MJF said after he revealed the t-shirt, he's like, oh, you know, I forgot I was wearing this. He's like, this shirt, it's obnoxious, it's regrettable, and quite frankly, it's very distracting, kind of like a neck tattoo. And that, you know, got ooh from the audience, didn't it? So, but earlier in this, before he said that for his, you know, he actually caught a really good backstage promo there. I thought he did really well on it. And he said that he's going to become the number one contender to the AEW World title, you know, and his sights were on Jon Moxley. So I thought that was set up really well. And that's a logical progression for him after he defeated Cody at the pay-per-view. He is somebody who should now be eligible for a match, to enter a match, so he can become the number one contender to the world title and, you know, challenge the current champion. So I thought that again was, you know, really good logical storytelling, taking us from, you know, point A to point C and remembering about point B, which again, the antithesis of what's been going on in WWE lately.
Yeah, they did a very good job. Well, listen, that's it for us here in the main podcast. Over in the overrun, we're going to be touching on NXT, a little bit of the end of Raw as well, and also a look back at another issue of Powerslam. But before we go, Finn, do you have any plugs that you'd like to give the lovely listeners?
No plugs, Kenny. You've got enough plugs and you need to hit them right now.
Well, we obviously patreon.com/insidetheropes where you can support us. It does genuinely make a difference if you're able to support us over there. It keeps us doing all these podcasts, keeps us being able to do all the stuff that we do. Also, youtube.com/insidetheropes for bonus interview content. We've got content out there with Kurt Angle, Triple H, Eric Bischoff, Chris Jericho, Paul Heyman, Mick Foley, loads and loads of people. And I'm actually going down to London on Wednesday to do some interview stuff with Drew McIntyre, who will be going on to WrestleMania face Brock Lesnar. So look out for that next week over on our YouTube channel. And also, we've got events coming out of our arse. We've got Kevin Owens. That's not the best way to plug it, but anyway. Kevin Owens on March 20th in Glasgow. Loads of ticket options if you want to get a photo with him, get an autograph, come to the show, get a photo and an autograph and come to the show. Loads of different options. Also, Trish Stratus in London. Those tickets go on sale tomorrow. And Kenny Omega in Glasgow and London in April as well. You can get all the information for those events at insidetheropes.co.uk/events. And you can select the event that interests you. So, Finn, I hope that you've had a nice time and I look forward to stopping this and getting to more topics on the overrun.
Absolutely. And you're looking forward to seeing those pictures of me in double denim.
Genuinely can't wait. Bye, everybody. If I be tonight, if I'm sad tonight.